You're listening to The Diplomat's podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, an editor at The Diplomat, and I'm joined today by my colleague and our Southeast Asia-focused editor, Prashant Parameswaran. Thanks for joining me, Prashant.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast will focus on two topics today. So first, we'll talk a bit about ASEAN. Last week marked the 48th anniversary of the Bangkok Declaration, which is that group's founding document. It was signed at the time by the five founding members of ASEAN: Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Thailand, and Singapore. Today, ASEAN has 10 members, is a major feature of the Asian political and economic landscape. The region stands as one of the most economically dynamic in the world and is home to over 600 million people. It's seen as a crossroads between East Asia proper and South Asia. And with Prashant on today's podcast, we'll take a bit to reflect on ASEAN's role in the current Asian geopolitical landscape. In the second part of the podcast, we'll very shortly reflect on Sri Lankan politics. As some listeners might know, Sri Lanka goes into a pivotal parliamentary election on Monday that could tell us about the country's political future, specifically whether the country's heavy-handed, authoritarian-leaning former president Mahinda Rajapaksa could return to the political scene as a possible prime minister, or if his successor Maithripala Sirisena and the current prime minister Ranil Wickremesinghe will stay on the scene and continue their sort of more open and deliberative politics on the island state that's still recovering after a civil war that spanned several decades. So anyways, Prashant, let's jump into the ASEAN side of things first. So ASEAN's motto is one vision, one identity, one community. In your view, how well do you think ASEAN how good of a job is ASEAN doing at living up to that motto today in 2015?
Yeah, so I think that motto is a really good place to start. So I think when ASEAN was founded back in August, so August 8th, 1967, there were fundamentally three goals that the organization was supposed to achieve in the decades that followed. So first was ensuring that the individual countries in ASEAN were able to develop and prosper, as well as ensure their own security. This was in the midst of the Cold War, that all these ASEAN countries regionally would be able to get along, because there were some conflicts between Malaysia and Indonesia, for example, before ASEAN was founded. And also, ASEAN would be able to engage the external powers, including the United States and eventually China, the European Union, et cetera, et cetera. I think the ASEAN countries individually and collectively have developed significantly. ASEAN has become a very strong economic force within the Asia Pacific in terms of economic prosperity, in terms of a destination for investment. People talk about ASEAN and Southeast Asia as a very dynamic place for economically speaking. But I think on the national front, individually, some of these countries are facing political challenges, and democratization for Southeast Asia and individual ASEAN countries has been a problem. Whether you look at Thailand, for example, which has regressed following the coup last year, or if you look at Myanmar, where, you know, as we reported in The Diplomat in the last few days, there's been a purge, which has implications potentially for the elections that are coming up. I think within the region, you still have a number of conflicts within and among some of these actors. So whether it's Thailand and Cambodia disputing a certain border, whether it's Malaysia and Indonesia dealing with some of their border disputes and arrangements, or it's differences on how to deal with the South China Sea, which gets to the sort of engagement of external powers, which I think is ASEAN's greatest challenge, which is
right.
How do you...
Let me actually just at this point bring up something that the U.S. Secretary of State had said recently last week. Yeah. On the sidelines of the ARF. He said ASEAN is essential to upholding the rules-based system in Asia and to ensuring that all countries, big and small, have a say in how we address shared challenges, including economic development, climate change, human trafficking, and marine conservation. So, you know, I think that goes to your point about ASEAN kind of being this this regional grouping helping all these countries that are individually smaller but collectively greater than the sum of their parts manage, you know, Asian geopolitics in Asia between the United States and China. What do you make of the Secretary's statements there?
Yeah, I mean, exactly as you said, I think it gets to ASEAN's broader role in terms of the engagement with external powers. ASEAN has grown from an entity that seeks to bring other powers in to basically the chief convening force in the Asia Pacific, and some would argue by default, just because regionalism in Northeast Asia is very difficult to achieve because of rivalries between China, Japan, South Korea. In Southeast Asia, ASEAN has become the sort of default convening mechanism for Asia-Pacific regionalism. That's where all the powers, including the United States, China, Japan, South Korea, want to be engaged in terms of looking at the issues, whether it's security, economic, or otherwise, in the region. So I think that is an opportunity for ASEAN because it has it has so-called convening power. But it also brings about a lot of challenges because when you're trying to engage external powers, you want to make sure that you're not overwhelmed as a region and caught between these various rivalries, whether it's, you know, the United States and China confronting each other over various issues and ASEAN sort of caught in the middle, or whether it's some of these other sort of geopolitical changes that we're seeing, whether it's Japan and its increasing security role, some of the U.S. alliances and partnerships that are working in the region. So it's a challenge for ASEAN moving forward, but I think what Kerry was trying to emphasize was that ASEAN is a important force for rule of law more generally in the region, because if you don't have ASEAN and the letter of the law, what you're left with alternatively is sort of a might versus right approach, right?
Right, and we're right. Obviously, yeah. And as we did on a recent podcast, we saw that with we are seeing that with the Philippines case against China. Let me push back a bit against this idea of convening power. I mean, convening power is obviously important in diplomacy. Oftentimes, a lot of things do get done simply by bringing the right people into the right room, which ASEAN is great at doing, don't get me wrong. But I think that the organization has seen the limits of that convening power, particularly recently with its attempts to incorporate China into the status quo regional order. And specifically, we don't have to get too much into detail on, you know, things like the declaration of conduct in the South China Sea or the current negotiations towards a code of conduct. But it seems like ASEAN is having some trouble converting its convening power into real sort of normative influence, particularly with regards to the rise of China.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that that's a fair criticism. ASEAN, when you're expecting it to do anything more than convene forums and try to manage some of these great power relations, I think you'll be expecting a little bit too much, particularly on the South China Sea question, because even though ASEAN has a role in trying to resolve the issue, the reality, as you pointed out, is that China is a much bigger actor in terms of capabilities. So if China wants to, as it has done for the past couple of years, move very slowly on the code of conduct, if at all, ASEAN doesn't really have much of a choice. And if China goes about changing some of the facts on the ground, ASEAN can protest, ASEAN can lean on the United States and other actors to try to change Chinese behavior. Some of the ASEAN countries can build up their own capabilities and try to resist what China is doing. But beyond that, diplomatically, there's very little that ASEAN can do. And on the other hand, the South China Sea question is something that, you know, you can't look at independently as well, as we've discussed many times. So some of these ASEAN countries are very happy, particularly some of these ASEAN countries in mainland Southeast Asia, very happy to take Chinese assistance on some of these economic initiatives.
Right.
And that creates a bit of a fissure. And there's not the kind of unity that we sometimes see in ASEAN that are reflected in the statement. There's a lot more divisions there. So.
Right. So how is the organization dealing with this sort of, you know, so-called north-south divide between ASEAN, where the mainland states that are geographically closer to China are less interested in the South China Sea issue, while the four claimant states that are in ASEAN, specifically Malaysia, Vietnam, Philippines, and Brunei, have a greater interest in seeing the South China Sea issue move forward? How is the organization dealing with that, or are they at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be an interesting question because Laos is going to be chairing ASEAN next year. And so we'll go back to a mainland Southeast Asian country chairing the organization next year. And I think the one thing I'll say, particularly on the South China Sea issue, is that 2012 and ASEAN's failure to issue a joint communique was unprecedented. And I think it sort of at least created a floor in terms of the minimum level of what ASEAN should achieve on the South China Sea, which is that we are not going to allow this one issue to undermine our regional consciousness and perceptions of ASEAN as an organization in terms of how capable we are. So I don't think you're going to see any more of these, you know, Cambodia-like failures to issue statements. So I think on that level, on that floor, that's already been created. I think beyond that, what you'll see is a tussle among the organization for more forward-leaning countries like Vietnam and the Philippines who want to include stronger language, and you'll see Cambodia and some of these other countries resisting it because they don't want the South China Sea issue to dominate discussions in ASEAN, but also ASEAN's overall relationship with China. You're going to see that tussle, but I think what the 2012 lack of a statement initially did was to set at least a floor so that ASEAN won't be divided in a way that is going to be very significant and debilitating for the organization. But beyond that, like you said, it's going to be a continual challenge because there's so much diversity of views within the organization about how this goes. So.
Right. Longer term, do you think ASEAN will, you know, retain the kind of convening power it enjoys today? I know that there's a few sort of challenges to ASEAN's dominance. I mean, specifically from China, you know, Chinese President Xi Jinping last year, he called for, you know, the conference on interaction and confidence building measures in Asia, KAIKA, and there's a few other, you know, Chinese-led organizations in the region. Obviously, the SCO, although it's a different organization, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. There's all these new sort of Chinese-led initiatives that are cropping up. And Xi Jinping seems to be very interested in this idea of building an Asia for Asians. And ASEAN, you know, when they hear that, I think they say, well, look, we've already been hosting, the, you know, all these forums here, the ARF, you know, ASEAN Plus 3. You know, this is kind of the beginning of an Asia for Asians organization, if anything. So how do you think longer term, as these Chinese organizations, a Chinese-led organization start to ascend on the Asian scene, how will ASEAN navigate and retain its relevance?
Yeah, so I think your question gets to the key issue, which is ASEAN centrality. How central is ASEAN going to be in terms of this regional architecture that is being built and is also being changed by some of these new Chinese initiatives? I think ASEAN centrality at base is pretty strong. So whether you have the ASEAN Regional Forum or some of these other maritime institutions that are dedicated to specific issues, or the East Asia Summit, which many powers, including the United States and other countries, are very interested in shaping into a leaders-based forum to address regional crises. So I think the centrality at base is very strong. And then I would say on the Chinese initiatives, the Chinese, you're right, are very adamant about trying to shape very strongly the future of the regional architecture. But I think they're going to bump up against resistance from, you know, not only some ASEAN countries, but also the United States, Japan, South Korea, Australia, some of these other actors. And I think in a way that sort of speaks to ASEAN's convening power, which is it's sort of a convening power by default in the sense that other countries are more comfortable with ASEAN as a collective entity taking the lead rather than individual countries like China. Or even Japan has also proposed, you know, for example, another organization for maritime security that at the track two level. ASEAN is just the default convening power because some of these other countries are very uncomfortable or wary about individual countries taking the lead other than Southeast Asia.
All right, great. Prashant, let's move the conversation over to the second topic that we have on the docket for today, which is Sri Lanka. And just so listeners know, Prashant and I aren't going to go too much into the domestic politics of the Sri Lankan election, although they are fascinating. And I'll put a few links in the description to this podcast where you can read more about the two specific alliances that are facing off in this election. The United People's Freedom Alliance, which is the party that the current president, Maithripala Sirisena, belongs to, and the former president also belongs to, Mahinda Rajapaksa, and the United National Front for Good Governance, which is the party of Ranil Wickremesinghe, who's the current prime minister in the country. But Prashant, since this is a podcast on Asian geopolitics, I kind of wanted to feel out, you know, the geopolitical implications of this election. By way of background, in January, when Maithripala Sirisena defeated Mahinda Rajapaksa in the country's presidential election, it was unexpected. And immediately afterwards, Sirisena was seen as a bit of a reformer, not only domestically, but also for the country's foreign policy. Under Rajapaksa, Sri Lanka had drifted very very closely towards China. There have been a lot of lucrative infrastructure contracts that have been awarded to Chinese companies that in part benefited Rajapaksa's family, according to ongoing investigations. But obviously, the perspective from India when Sirisena was elected was very positive. In his election manifesto, Sirisena had noted that Sri Lanka needed to have a balanced foreign policy. And in his first few months in office, he put his words to paper. He suspended Chinese projects in Sri Lanka, including the Colombo port city. He suspended Chinese port calls by Chinese warships to civilian facilities in Sri Lanka, including, I think, last November, a Chinese submarine had been seen in Colombo. And I remember that being a huge topic in the Indian media. It was, you know, Indians regularly worry about the string of pearls that China is establishing around the Indian Ocean. And Sri Lanka is obviously a major node in that. But anyways, Prashant, how, depending on the outcome of this election, and honestly, I've seen mixed expectations. This could be anybody's show. It could be a return for Rajapaksa. It could be a success for the incumbency. But if Rajapaksa returns to the scene, what do you expect that we'll see in terms of Sri Lanka's foreign policy?
Yeah, I mean, I think you summarized the distinctions pretty well. So if Rajapaksa comes to power, I think under his tenure, you definitely saw more of a tilt in Sri Lanka towards China, and also more problems in a relationship with India, just because there was the uncomfortable issue of how the government was dealing with the Tamils in the country. I think now, under the new government, you're seeing both of those dynamics change. So you're seeing not, you know, necessarily a cold treatment of China, but certainly a more balanced relationship with respect to the Chinese. And then secondly, you are seeing a little bit more of momentum towards addressing some of the reconciliation issues, even though the current government hasn't really made significant progress on some of these issues, and some of these issues are extremely challenging. I think on those two issues, you're definitely going to see a little bit of a shift if we see either not just Rajapaksa's return to power, but I would say if he manages to get a significant or strong showing in the parliamentary elections, what that's going to do is it's going to make the current government have more challenges when it comes to making shifts in both domestic policy and foreign policy. And if Rajapaksa and some of his allies can frustrate Sri Lanka's pursuit of a more balanced foreign policy and more reconciliation with the Tamils, that's going to be enough to at least make some of these issues a bit more complicated than some outside observers would like.
Right. Just another point that I think is a bit ironic is that as part of the reforms that Sirisena pursued in his first 100 days in office, he actually increased the powers of the prime minister. So if Rajapaksa were to come back, it'd be a bit ironic since, it would be Sirisena's reforms himself that would make Rajapaksa a more potent force as prime minister. But you're absolutely right that these reconciliation issues are obviously a huge part for Sri Lankan society. The country, like I said in the introduction to this podcast, is recovering from a decades-long civil war, which actually does have implications for foreign policy. I mean, specifically in India. In India, there's a huge geographic north-south divide in terms of where how Indian foreign policy should treat Sri Lanka. And obviously, this dynamic was a lot more pronounced during the Rajapaksa era because Rajapaksa was when he led the Sri Lankan army, he was he was seen as implicit in war crimes against the country's a Tamil minority. And obviously, Indian residents in the south of the country, in Tamil Nadu in particular, saw any sort of rapprochement between the central government in New Delhi and Colombo as unacceptable as long as Rajapaksa was in power. But with Sirisena, obviously, there's been a less of those elements have been less influential in New Delhi's policy. It also does help that Narendra Modi is a different sort of prime minister than Manmohan Singh in the Congress, who tended to react more positively to those sorts of impulses in southern India, but we've seen a bit less of that now.
Yep.
Prashant, anything else you want to add on the Sri Lankan elections? I mean, we're going to find out the results in about 3 days. We're recording this podcast on Friday. The elections are on Monday, so we may revisit this in a future episode. Anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to underscore the point that you already made, which is that there definitely is this with Rajapaksa more associated with this idea of Sinhala nationalism. And I think that is sort of one of the undercurrents that is playing out. So that obviously, if we see a return of that kind of sentiment, whether it's politically or otherwise, it makes it a little bit more difficult to pursue reconciliation with the Tamils in the country, which some see as, you know, one of the major, I guess, hurdles that Sri Lanka will have to overcome if it not only wants to get its domestic politics right, but also its foreign policy. Because as you mentioned, there definitely is that linkage, particularly with India.
Right, right. And, you know, I think that's actually one of this actually brings up one of Sirisena's strengths. I mean, he's Sinhala. He was part of Rajapaksa's government. He was his minister of health before he defected to run against the former president. So it's not like, you know, he's some sort of fringe minority candidate who has no sort of legitimacy among Sri Lanka's majority Sinhalese population. But you're absolutely right that there is this, you know, aura around Rajapaksa as the sort of icon of Sinhala nationalism, which sort of opens up these old wounds from the civil war. So I do think, you know, even, you know, for domestic policy, foreign policy, Monday's election result will matter tremendously.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, Prashant, thanks a lot for joining me on today's episode. And as always, we'll be back with more in the future. And if you like this podcast, do leave us a review on iTunes and let us know how we can improve things. Thank you very much for listening.